Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this 10th anniversary of the shock and awe beginning of the war with Iraq, we will look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with one of the most insightful chroniclers of the Bush-Cheney regime, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskin, the author of The 1% Doctrine, and discuss the selling of the Iraq war, the utter failure of our political opposition to stand up to the campaign of lies and propaganda, and the dismal performance of the press, who became the cheer squad of the Bush administration. Then we will speak with John Mearsheimer, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. He was one of 33 American scholars of international relations who signed a letter published in the New York Times 6 months before the Iraq War began, warning that a U.S. invasion of Iraq with no exit strategy will lead to occupation, urban combat, a victory for al-Qaeda, and increased anti-Americanism around the globe. Then finally, we'll examine a contemporary parallel of the rush to war with Iraq in the face of conflicting intelligence, a situation that is currently being repeated as the press parrot lies and distortions about Iran while failing to look at the actual intelligence data on Iran that the Director of National Intelligence presented to the Senate last Tuesday. Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, joins us. We will discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Three Facts to Note in the 2013 Worldwide Threat Assessment Report. Joining us now is Ron Suskin, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author whose books include the New York Times bestsellers The Way of the World, The 1% Doctrine, The Price of Loyalty, A Hope in the Unseen, and his latest book, The Confidence Man, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ron Suskind.
It's great to be here.
And Ron, of course, I noticed you in the Showtime documentary on Dick Cheney, and Dick Cheney's serene denial reminds me somewhat of what the founder of the neocons, Irving Kristol, said when he described neocons as being liberals who have been mugged by reality. But what I find extraordinary is that the reality of what the neocons wrought has in no way intruded on their delusions or diminished their influence in the press.
You know, they are innovators. Let's be frank. They're innovators at saying the sun rises in the west, in the west, in the west, despite the fact people say, I'm sure it was east this morning and yesterday and tomorrow. And I think part of what you see in Cheney is part of a strategic innovation of saying that it's difficult in this era when we don't have the Walter Cronkites anymore, saying that's the way it is with that kind of clarity of consensus, when you don't have the kind of preponderance of facts being accepted by all sides of the political debate. Not that ever it was easy, but now it is pernicious and almost impossible to manage some of those areas of consensus. The neocons, and Cheney is at the center of this, simply said, we will repeat it over and over. It doesn't matter what the indisputable facts say. If we don't flinch and we stick to script, ultimately we can get through this in one piece. And it's amazing to watch the film and see Cheney ever unflappable at what is just an avalanche, a tsunami of competing reality and absolutely irrefutable evidence. He, you know, I, of course, am in a way the provocateur in terms of a particular comment that a Bush administration official said to me back when about the reality-based community. Saying that I was a member of it, and people like me and other folks who believed in evidence were. But that's not the way the world works anymore, that essentially when we act, if we stick to our script as an empire, we create our own reality, especially at a time where claim has trumped fact and assertion has overwhelmed authenticity. And Cheney is testimony to it in the film we watched. I am untroubled by anything you say or any of the evidence that has accrued in these difficult years since Cheney was in power with Bush.
Well, but the faith-based diplomacy or faith-based foreign policy and this drive-by diplomacy and the drive-by war, if you like, that we suddenly got bogged down in, it's still going on. 60 people were killed in Iraq on the anniversary, the 10th anniversary. And frankly, Ron Suskind, the new Iraq war will begin fairly soon with the fall of the Assad regime. That will immediately be the catalyst for Iraq breaking up because the Sunni are already restive. The Kurds in the north haven't been getting their oil revenues from the central government that's corrupt and completely in the pocket of the Iranians. And frankly, that is the most amazing thing of all, is that the neocons and Bush and Cheney handed over Iraq to Iran.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This, in the famous parlance, of the era, 10 years ago, almost, it's actually 2004 this interview occurred, Tim Russert, in a rare interview with George W. Bush, framed it as best as I think anyone did in that period, saying, is this a war of choice? Now that we know there are no weapons of mass destruction here a year after the invasion, was this a war of choice or a war of necessity? Bush blinked. That's one of the few times you could really see him flinch. And he had asked Russert to define his terms. What do you mean by war of necessity versus choice? Ultimately, though, I don't think it was either one of those. It was a war of will, literally the will of Bush and Cheney and the men around them, and they're almost all men save Condi. From the very first National Security Council meeting of the Bush presidency in January of 2001, Bush and Cheney said, we want to invade Iraq. We don't need to even give a reason, frankly, but let's find a way to do it. That was the idea. And ultimately, at day's end, they found a way to do it. It was will. They willed this to occur. And what you have is a failed state in the center of this most troubled region of the world. As well, you have the United States acting in a willful way without clear cause. That has undermined our moral authority around the world. As somebody I talked to, a senior intelligence source, said to me recently, I said, you know, tell me what you think the legacy of this is. He said, you know, and he's been out there in the field representing America as an intelligence person for 30 years. He said, you know, we used to be the good guys, that we were different. But that is no longer the case. That's what Iraq did. It made everybody realize they're no different than anybody else. They're not exceptional, the Americans. They're not special. They do not move forward only when there is absolutely appropriate principle to justify action. And that's an enormous thing for us to lose on the world stage. And the question is, how do we get it back?
Well, of course, the legacy of torture is such that every two-bit dictator around the world, whether it's the Assads or the thug in Belarus or Mugabe in Zimbabwe, they can always say, well, you know, Americans torture their people too, so what's the big deal? I mean,
you know, there's a moment, you know, I mean, obviously what Cutler did, and more power to him, he got Cheney to talk, which is really what I think is bringing lots of people to the film. And then he had, you know, Bart Gellman, who's a great biographer of Cheney, and Woodward, Bob Woodward and I, and others talking about what the evidence showed. But, you know, there are moments where you'd say, gosh, it would be lovely, a kind of fantasy, to have a very knowledgeable questioner with the evidence in his hand, i.e., a Truth and Reconciliation type commission or a Senate committee there with Cheney under the hot lights to confront him. With precisely what has been wrought from this very troubling era that he and Bush presided over. You know, when you look at the basic facts of this situation, and he says, I am untroubled by the fact that we tortured people, which is essentially what he says, you know, part of you says, do you know the centuries-long battle that has raged, such that nation states have, on balance, not tortured people? They have learned the hard way, hard evidence, hard lessons, to not torture people they capture. I mean, it was one of the great leaps forward, you know, of civilization, that development. And Cheney just blithely says, not my problem. Yes, we have turned back what may be centuries of progress. But why worry? Why me worry?
Of course, the film that we're talking about, The World According to Dick Cheney, the Showtime documentary that you're featured in, Ron Suskind, is pretty extraordinary in the sense that it really shows, I think, for the first time, how much Cheney captured the Bush presidency from within. He staffed it while the Florida recount was going on. There were his people. He built the whole architecture of the Bush regime. The kid, if you will, didn't really know what was happening until later in the first term. But clearly things soured in the second term and they haven't spoken since and they're quite bitterly estranged. In his memoir, Bush did say that had he known that there were no weapons of mass destruction, he would never have gone to war. But when you mentioned the Meet the Press, that was a part, of course, the selling of the war, was it not? Where you had Judy Miller being fed material stuff from Cheney and Addington and Scooter Libby and Company directly from them. She put it in the New York Times. And then Tim Russert, when he interviewed Dick Cheney, closed the loop by quoting from the New York Times.
Let me be very clear here. Based on the evidence that I've gathered, and others have, but I am right at the center of this, is that from January of 2002, now a year and 3 months prior to the invasion, Bush set a ticking clock. I mean, Bush's idea that I didn't know, I don't buy it, and the evidence doesn't support it, to be frank. From that moment forward, a whole year, he set a ticking clock such that we will invade Iraq on a 1 year timetable to set up and launch an invasion. At that meeting in early 2002, the idea was, and with many of the leaders of the intelligence community in the United States there, the heads of the various organizations, they said to Bush, Saddam may not have any weapons of mass destruction. And the fact is, if you're going to base this war on that, you are rolling the dice. Because A, he might not have any, and B, even if he has any, they may not be findable with an invading force a year or a year and a few months from now. So Bush understood from the beginning that the whole case for weapons of mass destruction could be very thin. And maybe even if there were weapons, we wouldn't find them. So he was forewarned and forearmed on that point. What occurs here is that they didn't actually give the American people choice. Choice would have been laying out the actual areas of rationale for a war. They didn't do it. Well, but that would have been a very different discussion. Instead, they rested it on WMD. Clearly, by the fall of 2002, 6 months before the invasion, they knew that case was thin. And instead of stopping and saying, we need to actually tell people why we're going into Iraq, why we're doing this, what the justification for war is, instead, they simply pushed forward to craft what was a hollow case and really a lie upon which that invasion was based. Bush was involved right from the beginning. And for him to really throw it to Cheney, I don't think is correct. And the evidence doesn't support it either.
But Ron Suskind, doesn't that also bring into question the utter failure of our political opposition in signing up for this thing? Because, you know, I'd spoken with Senator Bob Graham, the head of the Intelligence Committee at the time. They weren't even going to do an NIE, the Bush people. Senator Graham forced them into it, and then the neocons, Doug Feith and company, distorted it. But members of the Intelligence Committee knew it was a bogus case, although John Edwards and Dianne Feinstein were the two Democrats that voted for the war. But that's no excuse for Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and others. I mean,
well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, look, let's just think back to that period. In that period, after 9/11, the year or two after 9/11, you know, Bush basically, you know, it was a war of will. The America that Bush presided over at that point was feeling, you know, a very, you know, understandable and unwieldy anger. A need for revenge, a need for action. And that was quite willful. The country was feeling a desire in its way to be willful, to show that America could do whatever it wanted to do and would not be trapped or defined by the actions of others, specifically the 9/11 catastrophe. Bush tapped that. Bush, already a person ideally suited for this, a willful guy from the start, tapped that unwieldy energy. And that's why this was a war of will. At that juncture, lots of people were getting evidence in the fall of 2002 that, my gosh, this case is based on very little. But the Bush administration pushed forward, and that was a predicate for war that ultimately was, I think, a willful lie. There was a great deal that was coming down the pipeline, as I point out in the book, The Way of the World, where they were getting competing evidence. We had the foreign minister, Sabri, saying to us, trust us, there are no weapons of mass destruction here. He said it in a back-channel intelligence operation. Habush, the intelligence chief of Iraq, met with U.S. and British intelligence in January, 3 months before the invasion. He said, there are no weapons in Iraq. And in fact, what he said, which ends up, of course, being clear to everybody a year later, this is prior to the invasion, he said, Saddam doesn't actually believe you would do anything as foolish as invade Iraq. We have nothing to do with al-Qaeda. You've got your hands full in Iraq. It doesn't make sense for the United States to invade Iraq. What he was fearful of is that if it was revealed he did not have weapons of mass destruction, it would reduce his authority with his neighbors. He was afraid of the Iranians. That's what Saddam was worried about. All this was clear to the United States well before the invasion. And the United States just said, we're moving forward. Look, from the first NSC meeting of the Bush presidency, the idea was, find me a way to invade Iraq. That was the concept. And the idea was, is that we will set up a client state of America in the middle of the Arab world, a country with oil reserves, and ultimately, as much as anything, in terms of the issue of WMD, we will make a demonstration model, an example of Saddam Hussein, because we can't stop people from getting their hands, failed states, dictators, whatever, getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction. It's carried in this era by civil technology. The technology is available. And so what the decision was is that if we make an example of Saddam Hussein, it will dissuade others from attempting what Saddam Hussein, frankly, wasn't even attempting at that point, but what he was stuck with in terms of our assertions. And that will be a kind of demonstration model, in a way, a kind of behavioral experiment for dictators and other rogue states around the world, so they don't in any way try to get their hands on WMD. That was, as close as I can figure, the thin reed. I mean, it makes the domino theory, look like something from Aristotle, but that was the thin reed upon which the rationale internally for war was often stated. They never said this publicly to the American people, but internally, that was their theory.
So, Ron Susskind, the neocons proconsul that they were going to install in Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi, who turned out to be an Iranian operative all along, is it possible he played us all along? In other words,
I think many people played us all along.
Right.
Clearly Chalabi had all sorts of connections to the Iranians. And if you want to know, again, 10 years later, when I talked to intelligence officials and others, what they say was the great missed opportunity here, and it's really a stunner, it's that in the months after this invasion, clearly an invasion based on false pretenses, but nonetheless, one that felt successful in those first few months as we drove quickly to Baghdad and the Saddam Hussein statue fell, who was knocking at our door? None other than the Iranians. This, in a way, was the great yield of this misbegotten war. In the few months after 9/11, the Iranians came to us, and they were spooked. We had X 100,000 troops in Iraq. We were in Afghanistan. And they came to us and said, okay, let's play ball. We can help you with Afghanistan. We know them very well. let's become partners, essentially, because they were terrified at this unilateral action by the United States. What was Dick Cheney's response to them? Get lost. Essentially, it was real men go to Tehran, and we will never sit down with the Iranians. Even though the Iranians literally crawled across broken glass to meet with us, Cheney snubbed them.
Now, here we are, 10 years later,
dealing with the Iranians. I mean, you talk about the definition of hubris. There it is, right there in your hands. That actually was a yield, a benefit that fell into our laps from the invasion. Arguably the only one I can find. And we threw it away because of Cheney's view, well, not supported by evidence or any insight into the geopolitical realities of the region, that this is just the first step, and eventually in his master plan will soon be in Tehran. It's a stunner, even now.
Well, just in closing, Ron Susskind, what was going on with George Bush Sr. and people like Bush Sr.'s National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, had warned against the folly of this war, and he had the opportunity, of course, to invade Iraq back in the first Gulf War and didn't because he knew what would happen. So clearly that information was out there and the father had it. Why did he allow the son to really, you know, embark on the greatest foreign policy blunder perhaps in the history of the United States, if not in the world?
Look, we talk about the reasons for this war, frankly, reasons that were not articulated to the American people prior to the invasion. Some of them very thin, some of them, you know, fanciful, frankly, by the neocons. But this was not just geopolitical. It was, in its way, Oedipal, too. There were very complex father-son dynamics, which have been written about. David Moranis does a terrific job writing about that, Washington Post reporter who's written extensively on it. Ultimately, the father's crowd was pushed away precisely because they were the father's crowd. And Cheney played that, as did Rumsfeld, brilliantly. They never had a great deal of respect for Bush 41, and they played to Bush 43's very complex feelings about his father, some of them, feelings of anger, feelings of inadequacy. The, you know, Bush 41, I gather, never treated 43 all that well in his growing up. Bush 43 was a real black sheep of that family. They played that artfully so that Brent Scowcroft and all the men around 41, around George H.W. Bush, were at best on thin ice coming into that White House. And ultimately, Cheney made sure that that ice broke. And I think that was a big reason why the lessons of the father did not, in this case, pass to the son. It was part of, frankly, a strategic plan by Cheney and Rumsfeld especially to make sure that the old guard, the 41 group, didn't have its way this time when it came to the big issues that only giants, as they would say, have the understanding and will to carry forward. That's really their view. We are the giants of history, and we will be eventually exonerated for the things we have done. And I think that right now, 10 years later, history's ledger is quite clearly loaded against that fanciful notion of exoneration.
Well, Ron Susskind, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian. Call anytime and be well.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ron Susskind, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author whose books include the New York Times bestsellers The Way of the World, The 1% Doctrine, The Price of Loyalty, A Hope in the Unseen, and his latest book is Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with one of 33 American scholars who predicted the disastrous outcome of the Iraq War 6 months before it happened.
come you masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs.
I just don't want you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Mearsheim, a professor of political science and the co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago. His books include The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, the bestseller The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and his latest, Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. He was one of 33 foreign policy scholars who signed a letter in the New York Times warning of the disastrous consequences of a war with Iraq 6 months before it began. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Mearsheim.
Thank you, Ian.
And, you know, when I read what you and your 32 other fellow foreign policy international relations experts wrote in the op-ed that was published on the op-ed page of the New York Times 6 months before the Iraq war began, at a time of war fever and with the administration figures like Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice talking about the smoking gun being a mushroom cloud, I'm inclined to read it quickly, if you don't mind. These are the points that you made. Saddam Hussein is a murderous despot, but no one has provided credible evidence that Iraq is cooperating with al-Qaeda. Even if Saddam Hussein acquired nuclear weapons, he could not use them without suffering massive U.S. or Israeli retaliation. The first Bush administration did not try to conquer Iraq in 1991 because it understood that doing so could spread instability in the Middle East, threatening U.S. interests. This remains a valid concern today. The United States would win a war with Iraq, but Iraq has military options, chemical and biological weapons, urban combat that might impose significant costs on the invading forces and neighboring states. Even if we win easily, we will have no plausible exit strategy. Iraq is a deeply divided society that the United States would have to occupy and police for many years to create a viable state. Al-Qaeda poses a greater threat to the U.S. than does Iraq. War with Iraq will jeopardize the campaign against al-Qaeda by diverting resources and attention from the campaign and by increasing anti-Americanism around the globe. Boy, talk about being prescient. I mean, that is almost chapter and verse what happened in terms of the disaster.
Well, I think, Ian, and I said this at the time, that it was quite easy to foresee that outcome. I found it remarkable that so many people who were products of the Vietnam War were willing to invade a country in the third world, a country with a rich history of colonialism, without even thinking that maybe things would go badly. What was remarkable about the Bush administration and those people on the outside who supported the war was how unequivocally optimistic they were about the outcome. Anybody who studied war knows that anytime you initiate a war, you can never be certain what the outcome will be. And when you go into a country like Iraq or you go into a country like Afghanistan, you should be especially wary that things will go south very quickly. But that was not how most people inside the Beltway thought about this one. They were very confident that this was going to be a quick and decisive victory, and then we would be on to the next country. I thought this was remarkably foolish at the time. But nevertheless, it was just the way most Americans were thinking.
Well, what I find extraordinary, though, John Mearsheimer, is that the warning that you and 32 other foreign policy scholars here in the United States offered to the American public via the pages of the New York Times went unheeded. At the same time, those same very pages of the New York Times, the op-ed page, Tom Friedman was shilling for the administration. And I spoke to one of the few people who knew about Iraq, Bob Baer, the CIA officer, and he said in retrospect he blames Tom Friedman as much as anybody for that war because he brought the liberals on and said it was okay for them to support the war.
Yeah. I think the New York Times ran three different op-eds by Kenneth Pollack, who made the liberal case for war. And many liberals said at the time convinced them that the war made eminently good sense. But there was no question that the Times, although it occasionally raised doubts about the case for the war, basically was on the bandwagon. And certainly newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post were helping to lead the charge. The fact is, we have here in the United States a mainstream media that is really incapable of doing serious work when it comes to foreign policy. The idea that the mainstream media would challenge any administration in a meaningful way is just not in the cards these days. And that was certainly true in the run-up to the Iraq War. And by the way, you see it today in the discussions about Iranian nuclear weapons. It's almost laughable how foolish our discourse in the mainstream media is about Iranian nuclear weapons.
You just mentioned, John, some of the Republicans opposed the war as well. Prominent among them was Dick Armey, who was a senior Republican in the House. And Dick Cheney went to him personally and lied through his teeth about what Saddam had in terms of weapons of mass destruction. And that's how he signed on to the war. This is all made clear in this extraordinary documentary about Dick Cheney, The World According to Dick Cheney on Showtime.
Yeah. Another prominent Republican who opposed the war was Brent Scowcroft. And the administration, in particular Condoleezza Rice, who was then the National Security Advisor, leaned very heavily on Scowcroft to keep his mouth closed after he wrote a op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in late 2002. Questioning the idea of going to war against Iraq. So lots of pressure was brought to bear on anyone who opposed to war not to speak loudly and clearly. I actually know a number of people who were opposed to the war but did not speak out because they thought that they would lose their credibility inside the Beltway. And this is one of the main reasons why there appeared to be so much unanimity in Washington at the time for fighting against Saddam.
So what does this say about American foreign policy, our understanding of facts versus fiction? Shouldn't we reward people who get things right and punish people who get things wrong? The idea that the Obama administration has hired all of the foreign policy experts who got it wrong, the idea that the neocons are still out there and unrepentant and talked to seriously in the press, I find it extraordinary. The people like yourself who got it right are not listened to, but the people who got it wrong are blithely soldiering on.
And helping to create all sorts of false images about Iran this time and pushing a war against Iran just as they were pushing a war against Iraq 10 years ago. Look, the fact is, Ian, there's hardly any accountability in the American system. You can be catastrophically wrong and you pay no price. And you are then free to go on and make more specious arguments about the need for more unnecessary wars. This is just how the United States works these days. Or maybe I should say it's how the United States doesn't work these days, because it's quite clear that our political system is broken. And when it comes to making foreign policy, we're just not doing very well at all.
So what then is going on this 10th anniversary? Are we seriously having second thoughts? I mean, you'd have to be blind not to notice what a disaster Iraq is. 60 people were killed there today by car bombs, etc. The only winner of the Iraq war was Iran. And now, of course, there'll be probably another Iraq war with the Assad's collapsing. And then that will ripple across Iraq and probably split the Sunnis and the Kurds off. And then you'll have an even another civil war, probably.
And I think you're missing one of the most important points. And that is that by invading Iraq in March 2003, we took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan. You want to remember that after we had defeated the Taliban in the latter part of 2001, the United States was in an excellent position in Afghanistan to work hard to create a stable regime in that country. But instead of concentrating on getting the job done in Afghanistan, what we did was take our eye off the ball and we invaded Iraq. And not only did we jump into a quagmire in Iraq, but then when things began to go south in Afghanistan, which of course happened because we were not there to work on fixing that situation, we were not in a position where we could go back to Afghanistan and fix it. So now we have a situation where the United States has lost in Iraq and is going to lose in Afghanistan. Two disastrous situations. So it's important, I think, to always remember that the decision to invade Iraq is inextricably bound up with subsequent events in Afghanistan. And that's not a happy story, of course.
Well, just in closing, John Mearsheimer, is there any possibility that in this soul searching that's going on now, as facile as it is, that there will be a moment of recognition of the monstrous folly that the Iraq war is and the price that the United States paid and continues to pay?
Well, I think some people recognize it. And I think the principal reason that the United States did not attack Iran last year and is probably not ever going to attack Iran, despite the fact that the Israeli government and the Israel lobby here in the United States is pushing us very hard to do just that, is because people realize that the last thing the United States needs is another war with a country in the Islamic world. So I think that the disasters in Afghanistan and Iraq have had a positive effect in regard to Iran, in that they have made President Obama and his lieutenants remarkably reluctant to start a war against Tehran. And I think that's all for the good. But nevertheless, a lot of the same people, especially the neoconservatives who pushed us into the war against Iraq, are working overtime to push us into a war against Iran, which would be another disaster for sure. And the Obama administration is filled with people who know this, which again is why they're so reluctant to do it. But nevertheless, the pressure is enormous. And as we said before, the press has just done a pathetic job of discussing the Iranian nuclear situation. And we have this crazy situation where, number one, most Americans think that the Iranians are on the verge of acquiring nuclear weapons, and that's their principal goal, when in fact the national intelligence estimates of 2007 and 2011 say that's not the case. And furthermore, most people seem to think that if Iran got nuclear weapons, that it could dominate the Middle East and coerce the United States to do all sorts of things it didn't want to do. And we have lots of theory and lots of history that shows us that's a ludicrous argument. But nevertheless, if you read the mainstream media, to include the New York Times and the Washington Post, that's not the picture you get. So things are in a pretty sad state when it comes to the mainstream media in the United States.
Well, John Mearsheimer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with John Mearsheimer, professor of political science and co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago. His books include The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, the bestseller The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and his latest, Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. He was one of 33 foreign policy scholars who signed a letter in the New York Times warning of the disastrous consequences of a war with Iraq 6 months before it began. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about how the build-up to the Iraq war is repeating itself with lies and distortions about Iran's nuclear program.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Impatient after impatient, this means war, this means war.
Someday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Three Facts to Note in the 2013 Worldwide Threat Assessment Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you for having me.
And the president is on his way to Israel, where he'll meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And just before he left, he offered a New Year's greeting to Iran, the Nowruz message, where he said the Iranians had paid a high and unnecessary price for Tehran's unwillingness to satisfy concerns over its nuclear program. But what you have been writing in the Huffington Post and is, I think, alarming in the context of the 10th anniversary of the rushed war in Iraq, based on lies and distortions that the press dutifully parroted. Is that what's happening now, that the press is basically going along with a kind of rush to war narrative with Iran and ignoring the very contradictory intelligence testimony that was presented last Tuesday to the United States Senate by the head of American intelligence, the Director of National Intelligence?
Correct. I mean, what we're seeing right now is worrisome, and it's been like this for quite some time. When you read the report of Clapper, and we should remind ourselves, Clapper is the person that has more access than almost everyone in the U.S. government to intelligence. He's also a person who has access to intelligence of several other countries who share it with the United States. When you read his description and assessment of the nuclear program in Iran taking place there, it is so starkly different from what we're hearing in the media, in the mainstream media. In the mainstream media, we have a rather panic-stricken conversation about Iran, one that leaves people with the impression that Iran actually already has a nuclear weapon. Several U.S. polls have shown that the American public has come to that conclusion based on listening to what they hear in the mainstream media. And that, of course, is entirely false. They don't have a nuclear weapon. They have a nuclear program. There's some serious concerns about it, but there's also serious ways and opportunities to be able to deal with it. And it reminds us of what happened in Iraq, precisely because of the fact that there was a conversation in the media in that specific case driven by the government itself, by the administration, and a conversation in the intelligence community, at least before the intelligence community was manipulated into moving its assessments to fit the policy that the administration wanted. And we see that parallel. It may not be driven by the same forces or, you know, the same entities within the government, but it is a huge disconnect when you turn on your TV and you listen to what is being said, and then you read the intelligence report. It gives quite a different picture.
Well, I remember, Trita Parsi, some time back before the vote was taken to authorize the Iraq war, speaking with Senator Graham, who was the head of the Intelligence Committee, and apparently the Bush administration were rushing into the Iraq war without a national intelligence estimate on Iraq's threat. And it was only because Senator Graham insisted on an NIE that it was even presented in the first place. And as you know, it was doctored and distorted by Doug Feith and the neocons. But it was swallowed whole by almost all of the key Democrats, John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. But those on the Intelligence Committee who knew the actual document did not vote to authorize that war, with the exception of John Edwards and Dianne Feinstein. So we've already gone through this movie now. Of course, as you pointed out, the players are different now. The neocons don't run the Department of Defense and run the White House foreign policy through Dick Cheney. But what explains the press's failure to report on what Clapper has said? He is the top intelligence guy in the country. So his analysis should be the standard.
Yeah, no, I agree. And let me just quickly go over some of the things that I think is quite interesting what the press is saying. You know, in the press, we've heard a lot about this debate as to whether the red line should be nuclear weapons capability or nuclear weapons. And that's been much of the struggle also between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government in Israel. Well, when you listen to what Clapper says or what he writes in his report, essentially says that Iran is already there. At this point, the only thing that stands between Iran having a nuclear weapon and not having one is a political decision, meaning that a decision by the leadership there to go in that route or not to go in that route, which is very different from saying that if they just have the capability, then we're already at war or we should be at war. We're already at that point. So it renders some of the conversation about where the red line should be somewhat, you know, mute, frankly. The other thing that is quite interesting is that, as I mentioned earlier on, the debate in the United States in the media tends to be rather panic-stricken. The perception of a suicidal, fanatical, irrational entity on the other side. When you read Clapper's report, he describes the motivations of the Iranian government, not entirely, but largely as defensive. That much of what they're doing is about their deterrence capabilities and their intent to be able to deter any invader and their desire to be able to have retaliatory options, etc. Which is, again, these are not necessarily positive things or an idea that, you know, there's no problem. And he's making it very clear. There clearly is a problem with the Iranian nuclear program. But it is not this entity that is hell-bent on destroying the world, as one otherwise would believe if one listens to the mainstream media. And I think the third takeaway is an indication of what our own polity has done. He talks about the tremendous economic difficulties that exist in Iran right now, and describes that to be, to a large extent, because of the regime's incompetence, its corruption, mismanagement, but also large part due to the sanctions that have been imposed in the last 2 years. But he also points out that Iran is growing more autocratic at home and more assertive abroad under these circumstances. That in spite of the economic pain, in fact, to a certain extent, due to the economic pain, Iran is becoming more undemocratic at home and more problematic abroad. None of this, in my estimation, or as I went through the media, was accurately or appropriately reported in the media. And then it's even worse when you look at what some members of Congress are telling their constituents, when they're writing letters to members of Congress and asking for answers and, you know, expressing opinions on what we should do on Iran. One senator from New York, for instance, was telling constituents that Iran is continuing to enrich uranium at the weapons-grade level, which is something that U.S., Israeli, and European intelligence is saying is not taking place. But that's what that senator is telling constituents.
So when you read this report by the Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, which is available for anybody to see, and it makes the case that Iran is essentially interested in nuclear weapons in terms of developing their capabilities to enhance its security prestige and regional influence, but hasn't made the political decision to go ahead and build one. And that is the red line. And the more we pressure them, the more likely they are to cross that red line. And that Iran's nuclear, quoting Clapper, Iran's nuclear decision-making is guided by a cost-benefit approach, which offers the international community opportunities to influence Tehran. There it is, right? There's the invitation that if we decide, as people like Vali Nasser have recently suggested, that sanctions drive Iran's insecurity, which in turn makes Iran consider seeking nuclear weapons as a defense. So that seems to me to be the message here, isn't it?
To a certain extent it is, in the sense that when Clapper is saying that it's a political decision that decides whether Iran will go in that right or not, they have the capability, the question is what do they decide to do, then the question is, okay, how do we affect their decision-making? How do we affect their desire to go in the right direction rather than going in the wrong direction? Is more crippling sanctions that is leaving them with the impression that it's just a first phase, weakening them before there actually is an invasion, something that will help convince them not to pursue a nuclear deterrence? I personally doubt it, and I think it's quite clear when you talk to people from the intelligence community who, again, I want to emphasize, are not underestimating this problem, are not believing that this isn't a problem, but do point to facts that indicate that our approach and our conversation is not necessarily the smartest one, or at least not the most effective one.
Well, the fact that the sanctions, although they've obviously caused a tremendous pain in Iran, have not led to the unraveling, or at least more social protests, what they've in fact led to is more repression on the part of the government. So, in effect, the Iranian people are suffering. The regime is not changing. So often, Dr. Tridipasi, what we do is to satisfy our own sort of impotence in a way, that sanctions are wherever we impose them. I mean, and the best example is the ridiculously long sanctions against Cuba, which has just kept the regime in power. I mean, aren't we repeating that dynamic?
We are repeating that dynamic because it's the least politically costly path for decision makers in Washington. There isn't a political cost to be paid for members of Congress to vote for new sanctions. There is a political cost to be paid if you actually courageously stand up and say, hey, let's actually truly invest in diplomacy and get this issue resolved. I mean, even President Obama had the option of agreeing to a deal that he himself and his administration had helped design, that Turkey and Brazil succeeded in getting Iran to accept. But at that point, when they gave the acceptance, the choice was between a sanctions resolution at the UN or the breakthrough in the negotiations. And Obama chose the sanctions because it was only 6 months till the midterm elections, and politically it would be problematic for him had he pursued diplomacy and the breakthrough that actually was there.
Well, given that the president just said in his New Year's greeting to the Iranian people that to date the Iranians have been unable to convince the international community that their nuclear activities are solely for peaceful purposes, and obviously that's a question that arises. Why are they putting the country through such pain in order to do in secret what they say they're not doing, but which the intelligence community apparently believe that they are in a position, if they'd make the political decision to build a bomb, they could do it very quickly. Now, if they were to do that very quickly and build a bomb, that would be the red line, and that would invite a military strike, would it not? So
there's a likelihood of that, and beyond that, if they were to go that route, military strikes could be launched long before they actually reach a bomb. That's important to understand. The dash-out time that they have between deciding to pursue a bomb and getting a bomb is still around 6 to 12 months, whereas inspections would catch them between 30 to 60 days into the process.
But doesn't this say that at this moment you have maximum leverage on both sides, that there's an incentive on both sides to make a deal?
There is, but there is one, you know, there's several significant problems. There's a huge amount of mistrust between the two parties. There is quite a lot of understandable suspicion on the U.S. side as to whether the Iranians, and particularly Khamenei, is truly willing to fully resolve this issue. But there's also a question mark on the Iranian side. As some part of a deal, there has to be sanctions relief. There's not any conceivable situation in which the Iranians would give up major elements of their program and sanctions would still be there. The problem, though, is it's so politically costly and burdensome to lift sanctions, particularly since most sanctions go through Congress. That is Obama truly capable of delivering the promise of sanctions relief if the Iranians were to compromise?
Well,
and when those doubts exist, it renders success in the negotiations very, very difficult.
Well, again, Vali Nasr's piece in the New York Times suggests that Washington should offer to do away with specific sanctions piece by piece in exchange for specific Iranian concessions. I mean, that's a pretty obvious roadmap, isn't it? If you're in this standoff situation, that's the exit strategy, isn't it?
That is the exit strategy. And I would argue that there are plenty of folks in the U.S. government that would very much like to take that route because they have sufficient belief in the value of trying this route. The problem is they're not necessarily making the decisions, because even if the executive branch were to decide to go to the table, put serious sanctions relief on the table, and in return request significant concessions from the Iranian side, the question then is, are they capable of delivering the promise of lifting sanctions, mindful of the fact that it's actually Congress that decides whether these sanctions are lifted or not? And I'm sure, as you know, and as the listeners know, it's not as if Congress and the president have the best of relationships right now on any issue.
Well, excuse me. Well, Dr. Tridipasi, the disparity between the White House and the Congress, we know about the rejectionist Republican House, but we also know that the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, has tremendous influence on Capitol Hill, and it has for the longest time since 2009, in fact. Prime Minister Netanyahu has managed to completely change the subject from the Israeli-Palestinian problem to the Israeli-Iran problem. And as you know, they've tried to involve the United States in somehow giving permission to strike, etc. That's been going on for some time. So is that where the problem lies, that you really basically, and particularly given that the president is going to be meeting with Netanyahu, that you've essentially got a Congress that's under the thrall of AIPAC, and somehow Israel's foreign policy is more important than America's?
You have a situation in which there clearly is a division between the route to go, and on the Israeli side, there is not much enthusiasm for the diplomacy, certainly not any enthusiasm for making a deal in which sanctions would be lifted, which essentially means that there's not going to be any deal. And you have then elements in Washington, D.C. that lobby for an agenda that is almost identical to that one, and they have a tremendous amount of influence in Congress. And the difference is that we actually have a more open conversation about this today than we had 5 years ago or 10 years ago. There was even a New York Times editorial last weekend that by name pointed out AIPAC's negative role and pointed out that Congress is making it much more difficult and actually standing in a way of a deal, particularly at a moment in which there seems to be some promise that perhaps a breakthrough can be found.
Well, Dr. Tridipasi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Three Facts to Note in the 2013 Worldwide Threat Assessment Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Appeared by